Good to have you here this morning. We're in Revelation chapter 13. In the beginning of the book of Revelation, chapter 1 and verse 1, it gives us an indication of how the book would be communicated. The New American Standard uses the word communicated. It says this: the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his bondservants the things which must shortly take place, and he sent and communicated it by his angel to his bondservant John. My footnote says there, rather than communicated, it could also be translated as signified, which I like, because the idea of, if you would, signified, this is being shown in signs or in pictures. And as J.J. did a great job of trying to paint that picture for us last week in the 12th chapter, we find really that here in the 12th chapter, it deals with the birth and the outcome of the Son. And so Jesus is brought into the world. The devil is trying to consume him, trying to destroy him, but he's caught up into heaven out of a further threat of the devil. And in the course of that, what we find is that the devil is not happy at all. As a matter of fact, the last part of the chapter tells us that he is going to try to destroy God's people. It says down in verse 12, chapter 12, "For this reason, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, knowing that he has only a short time. And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman." Now, as we talked about last week, I understand this woman, starting in verse 1, is talking about God's people. If you would, the Israel, the faithful Israel, the Old Testament. And as that unfolds then, and the Old Testament is taken out of the way, the faithful of God's people under the New Covenant. And so the devil is set out to make war against the offspring, the people of God, the saints, in this particular chapter. And we find that he has just a short time. And so he comes with great wrath in the middle of verse 12, knowing he has but a short time. Now, I have tended to think of that sort of through the years as earth time in general, but I lean towards he's just talking about this period of persecution especially. Again, his time is limited as the book goes on. But we see time, and half-time, those statements, this period of direct persecution, it seems to me contextually that the evidence sort of weighs that way. And so the devil is really out giving his full wrath against God's people as we see this chapter unfold. But God delivers his people with the wings of an eagle. That's terminology that's used at the end of the Exodus, after God delivered them, and describes God's delivery. He uses that kind of terminology there. And in the wilderness, again, I tend to relate to this as talking about Elijah, that 3.5 years, which would be the same as time times half times to 1,260 months. Is that right? No. Anyway, these terms that are in here. And so it's a period of persecution that will come to an end. And we see that's what happened in the days of Elijah when it didn't rain. So that seems to be, in my perspective, the imagery. But it talks about the woman in verse 14, the woman in verse 15, the woman in verse 16, the woman in verse 17. And so it's trying to bring to our attention here God's people, and that the devil is the adversary against them. And as we wrapped up at the end of chapter 12 last week in verse 17, and the dragon... Who is the dragon?
Satan.
Okay, the chapter tells us back earlier in verse 7, and so it gives us particulars about that 7 in verse 9. And so Satan, or the dragon, was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. So that's a description of really who these offspring are. People that hold fast, if you would, to the testimony of Jesus and keep the commandments of God. And we see those concepts through here a number of times. This is the spirit of the people that are serving God. They're holding fast to Jesus and are keeping the commandments and the will of God. That's always been the case. In the Old Testament, the woman in the Old Testament, the remnant were people who had this trusting, obeying faith, and that they would keep the commandments of God the best they could. And so they were faithful to God in that. So we see that picture in this at this point. Now, the dragon here in verse 17, this isn't the end we're going to hear about him. He's the one that is, if you would, waging war against God's people. And in chapter 13 in verse 1, it says, "And he stood on the sand of the seashore." And it was mentioned last week that there's some question about whether it's I or he. I think the ESV uses he stood. I think the NIV says the dragon. And I think contextually, personally, that's what he's talking about. Here is the dragon that's persecuting the woman. In chapter 13 is basically just going to tell us, here are the tools, if you would, that the dragon uses against the people of God. And so he's standing on the seashore, and what's going to happen in verse 1 is up out of the sea comes a certain beast. And then when we get down to verse 11, out of the sea comes another beast. And so we're going to discuss those this morning in the course of our study. But we find it is the dragon that empowers them as you go through the chapter. And that's another reason why it would seem very appropriate. It could be John standing on the seashore and watching these, so I'm not discounting that. But anyway, I think that the NIV translated it dragon, ways their perception of the context as well in the manuscripts, but I'm not big on the NIV. But anyway, I think that's notable. All right, now let's try to do here for a moment, and I'll just tell you, my head's not working like it normally does. I'm still suffering from anesthetic. Deborah asked me to do something for her yesterday. She had to repeat it 3 times for simple instructions. And so I'm gonna milk this for all it's worth. But in chapter 13, what are the players, if you would, that you see in here? And Carl's been doing that each week, and I think that's a great thing to do in this book. So who is described, or who is introduced, if you would, or who is talked about in this chapter?
Dragon and the two beasts that he gives power to.
Okay, so we see the dragon is in here, and we're going to see two beasts. One, it says, comes up out of the sea in verse 1. The other, out of the earth in verse 11. Okay, what else do you see in here?
In verse 3,
talks about the whole earth. Okay, so you got the whole earth. And when we talk about basically the whole earth, typically what's that talking about in the book of Revelation? Yeah, okay, all people, but especially the unregenerated. Okay, the earth, that's there. But yeah, all people. But these that are following the beast, as we study down through here, things are going to be in chaos. We'll talk about it, and they are amazed. But it could be talking about just all of humanity, those serving heaven and those serving earth. Okay? Where does the beast get its power? Verse 2. Okay, from the dragon. So we specifically have that stated. Okay, what else do you see in here? Okay, you have the saints down in verse 7. They're going to make war with the saints. Okay, and I would suggest as you look in there, the saints are in contrast here to the earth dwellers, those living for heaven, whose citizenship is in heaven, if you would, and those who are upon the earth. Okay. What else do you see in the chapter?
The people are inhabitants of the earth are going to worship the beast.
Okay. And so the inhabitants of the earth that he talked about here are going to worship the beast. Those are what we express as the earth dwellers, the people living for this world, if you would, rather than serving God in heaven. Okay. What else?
You can see that his tool is deception.
Okay. We're going to see that. What's back in verse 11? That's exactly right. But in verse 11, what else is introduced? Okay, the second beast, okay, that we've mentioned already. So here is the a beast that comes up out of the earth. And I will just suggest, so I don't forget to do so later, why do they come up out of the sea and earth? We talk about land and sea, but if they are earthly, that's their origin. They didn't come out of heaven. When you look at the Lamb, you look at all that's associated with that, comes out of heaven. But this is of earthly nature, earthly wisdom, and earthly power. It's demonic, ultimately. And so we see that. Okay, and so what is unique about this beast in verse 11? What's different from the sea and the earth beast here, if you would? And I'm looking for the description of verse 11, is what I'm trying to get to.
It had two horns like a lamb.
Okay.
It spoke like a dragon.
Okay, it had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. How was the first beast described earlier there in verse 1? Okay. Yeah, he has 10 horns, 7 heads, his horns, he has 10 diadems, and his heads were blasphemous names. So these two beasts have some distinctions, okay? What else do you notice there in verses 11 and following about the second beast?
He got his authority from the first beast.
Okay, he gets his authority from the first beast. So they're tied together here. And where did the first beast get his authority? Who gave him power?
The Satan,
the dragon. And so both of them are empowered ultimately by Satan. They're both serving the dragon, Satan there. And so they are connected, but they're going to be two different aspects, as we'll talk about. And Deborah mentioned just a moment ago that he operates on the basis of deception, verse 14, which is a very important thing to notice. Okay? We'll talk about that as we look through the text. And he performs these various signs. What else do you see in the book? We see that he's going to oppose the saints and persecute the saints, has already been introduced. But what happens down in verse 16, 17?
They receive a mark.
Okay, we're going to be talking about a mark here of some kind. Okay, so I'm just going to leave that there at the moment. So we have the mark spoken of here, those who have the mark and those who don't. Okay, and what happens to those that don't have the mark in these verses?
They can't buy and sell. They can't.
Okay.
Okay,
so they're discriminated against, if you would. Back, you remember, in the opening of the seals in chapter 6 and about verse 5 or something like that. In the opening of that seal, you see that discrimination. It talks about that, and then that partial judgment that's given here. Here we see, I think, that also described. And then the last verse here, the New American Standard says, "Here is wisdom." And I like that translation. You want to understand something, this verse goes ahead and tells us, and we'll talk about that at the end of our class. But I'll stop there, as he talks about the number of this, and so the 666 and all that's been so popular forever. Okay, well, let's go back at the beginning here, and as we see our text in verse 1, and he stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 heads and 7 head, 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth was like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. And I saw one of the heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. And they worshiped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him?" And there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies and authority to act for 42 months, which was given to him. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in the heaven. And it was given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is destined for captivity, to captivity he goes. If anyone kills with the sword he must be killed. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints. And so that concluding statement, here is the perseverance or the patience and the faith of the saints. And helping us understand what's going on here and that these challenging times were coming. Again, it has been pointed out by myself and others in the study of this book, suffering is not the same thing as punishment. As judgment is brought upon what goes on here, oftentimes the saints had to suffer. That didn't mean they were being punished for their wrong deeds. And so we've seen that again and again. And bear in mind, as this admonition is here, he's talking about the adversary. Now, does it sound like a formidable adversary? Yeah, it does. The devil is a formidable adversary. And I'll tell you what, anytime we get sitting back comfortable, and we don't think the devil is a formidable adversary, we are putting ourselves in jeopardy. Every one of us, me, you, John.
Just a little bit of a different version. The ESV on that last sentence.
Right.
Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints.
Okay. Yeah, very good. Okay.
Which is more of a stay faithful.
Okay.
You can endure this.
Very good. Okay. I appreciate that. That's a good observation. And I did my study this time out of the ESV, so I've got it up here marked on the side. And there are a couple variations through here along that line. That's a good observation. I appreciate that, brother. In this chapter, it tells us about this beast that comes up out of the sea. And as it describes him with his horns and his head, we're going to find that that's not the first time that this statement has been expressed in the Bible. Does anybody have an idea when this might have been stated previously? Okay, in Daniel chapter 7. And you remember, and I think it's helpful for us maybe a little bit. It makes it a little easier maybe to work with. When we think about Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 basically telling the same story. Many of us are very familiar with Daniel chapter 2. The image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream. Babylon and Medo-Persia and the Greeks and the Romans, the four kingdoms, and then a stone was cut without hands and struck the image at the feet. It fell, but that stone grew into a great mountain, the kingdom of God, as is described there. Well, that's what Daniel 7 also is describing, except as the chapter unfolds, he gives more details, especially about the fourth kingdom, because Daniel is wondering about that. And as you look back through here, and what I did just for make it easy is I printed Daniel 7 out the other day as I was preparing for this. And down through here in verse 21, it says, I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them. That sounds sort of familiar in chapter 13. And in verse 22 of Daniel 7, until the Ancient of Days came and gave judgment, judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Down in verse 25, he will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. And that will be for time, times, and half times, as he says there in verse 25. And then in verse 27, the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints. And so you see here this oppression, this persecution against the saints. Daniel 7 strongly brings it out. And it's really, as I think Carl said, it's a sort of a spoiler, I think was the term he used. Daniel 7 really gives you the thrust, I think, of what the book of Revelation is all about. And I agree completely with that. Now, back earlier, you find in verse 20 of Daniel 7, and the meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head and the other horn which came up and before which three of them fell, namely that horn, which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boast and which was larger in appearance than its associates. And so what you have here early in the chapter, and I just have verse 18 and the end, you have this beast described, that's in verse 1 primarily. And as it describes him here in verse 2, in Revelation chapter 13 and verse 2, he says, I saw like a leopard and a bear and the mouth of a lion, which is interesting because those are the first three creatures in the vision of Daniel chapter 7, talking about Babylon, Medo-Persia, and the Greeks. And what happens out of them, all that sort of flows into the Roman Empire, I think is probably the idea with this. Certainly that is true historically. And so it seems to be why the imagery is used here. And she absorbed many of the things from these previous empires in what they did. Now, there's also another a place in the 17th chapter of Revelation. We're not going to go over there. And Carl's been doing a great job of not sneaking ahead and trying to pull things in. And he's been trying to keep it straightforward chapter by chapter, very simple. And that's a great, great thing that he's doing. But in chapter 17, we're going to see some of the same terminology used and described over there. And we're going to find that what happens is that it looks like the beast is falling apart. And that's sort of the fatal wound. But its wound was healed in verse 3. You see the same thing in Revelation chapter 17. There are some, and I'm tempted to do this, but I haven't been willing to do it, is talking about the first seven Caesars, talking about the Nero, and then there was civil war that took place in just a couple of months. Each of the next three were there. And then as that unfolded, finally, then it comes to Domitian, who did that persecution again. And I think that's the idea, but I am not at the place to take a literal this king, this king, this king, this king in the numbers. But the fact is that when Nero went down, Rome went into a civil war, and their own historians are writing, like, is the empire going to make it? Things were that bad. Because when you lose your king and you lose your rule and everybody's vying for power, there's all kinds of chaos. Oh, we see a little bit of that in our own world, don't we? But we see that. But what happens then is Vespasian steps back in and stabilizes things, and Domitian is going to be the power here that's going to persecute again. And this seems to be a description of that. And again, I don't want to put the literal number of kings and rulers in here. I think this figurative language is being used in such a way that it draws that point without trying to just assign each one of these names. I think that has its challenges also, just to be frank. But it is very tempting to me. But anyway. So questions or comments about that? I hope I haven't stirred up the water and made it so muddy because of this language in here. Okay. And so it looked like the beast, he was slain. Okay. I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. So that's what I was trying to describe here just a moment ago. Again, that same thing is over in chapter 17. And you see in chapter 17, it talks about kings rather than using the word kingdoms. And so we'll cross those bridges when we get to chapter 17. Okay. Questions or anything about that? Yeah, it's always happened.
And the only way to combat the chaos is to look to the Lord for comfort and for direction so that we don't get caught up in the chaos.
Okay.
It would be too easy to get caught up in it. It's very easy to get caught up in it.
It is. And there's always been this cycle of the world at conflict with God's people, righteousness and wickedness. That war has been going on from the beginning, as soon as the devil stepped into the scene in Genesis chapter 3. So that's true. And I think that's a great point that we get caught up in. And I'll mention something about that at the end of the sermon this morning, so I think it's a good observation. But particularly here, what we're finding in the Revelation is the persecution and the struggles that the saints, the kingdom of God, the church, if you would, is being challenged with at the end of the first century. And the way I like to express it from Daniel chapter 7 is that the devil is stomping the fire out of the saints, and it looks really bad for them. Except Daniel 7 goes ahead to say, but God stepped in and gave judgment for his saints. And it says not only had they received, then it says they possessed. And so at the end of this, when the kingdom is tested, it does survive. That's the point. And the book of Revelation is giving us a far extended detailed image of what Daniel 7 describes, I believe. And the kingdom of God will not be done away. And I'm firstly at a place where at the end of the book of Revelation, that's at the end of chapter 20, or in the middle of chapter 20, that's where I'm at with some of the comments that are in there. The point really is the enemies of God will not overcome God's people. And so, but that's another story. We'll talk about that in chapter 20. Now, what else do you notice in our chapter here about this beast? As you look at him described in verse 1, what kind of a power is especially focused on here in the words that are used? Okay. 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 Yeah. Ten horns reflects power, and diadems is the word for like a kingly, a regal power. And so we're talking about, I believe, the civil power of Rome in this section of verses. And so this is the aspect of that this beast is describing, that the devil is using Rome, if you would, as an instrument against the people of God. And we're going to see in chapter 13 and in verse 11, again, the second beast has another flavor to it. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I think that's right. I think we're talking about the Roman Empire as it is, its regal power and the military power that's associated with that. And they dominated the world. And they ruled by force and by might oftentimes. They had laws and certain things in place. But when the Caesars got to a certain point in time, they were just against God's people. And that's what we're seeing, the suffering, that they're against the saints. They're stomping the fire out of the saints in here. What else do you notice about this beast, as Deborah just mentioned? What's written on his head? Blasphemous names. What does that mean? Okay. So he's arrogant, he's full of himself, which is not a new concept. You go back and you study about the Chaldeans and the Assyrians and so forth, you see descriptions of them, their arrogance, their God is their power and all. But they have blasphemous names. They're opposing God. And what happens is not all of the Caesars, but the Caesars required that they would be worshipped at certain points in their history. And Domitian was a part of that. And they had that something called the Concilia, which were their priests that would go around and make people offer incense, or they would be persecuted against in some way, shape, or form. Sometimes killed, other times discriminated against, as we'll talk about later in the chapter. But they're against God, they're against righteousness. Even though there's a civil war and the fatal wound was healed, people stood amazed at that, and they worshiped the dragon in verse 4. Again, the dragon is who? Satan. They worshiped Satan because he gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to wage war with him? Has there ever been a time in American history where America, we think we are safe, we've got ballistic missiles, we've got the finest army, we are safe and secure because... Ever been any thoughts like that? A lot of them.
Right before 9/11.
Yeah. And years and years before, and years after. And so what we have to be careful is that I'm thankful to have lived in a nation where there's a great level of security and law and order. There has been in my lifetime, much more so than in so many countries. Yeah, it's not perfect, but I am thankful for that. But what we find is that if we start putting our trust in those things, we've put our trust in the wrong things. And so the people of the world are saying, okay, who is like the beast? Here's our security, here's our power, here's our provider. I mean, that's the idea. They're looking to him. And he has power as he speaks arrogant words and blasphemies and authority for 42 months. And again, as we've said, that's that period of persecution, 1,260 days, 42 months, 3.5 years, times and halftime. And those are used in Daniel and Revelation, talking about this period of persecution. And so he has authority here. This way. And he speaks these blasphemies against God, his name, his tabernacle, and that is those who dwell in the heaven. So here are the heaven dwellers in contrast to the earth dwellers. God's people as opposed to the devil's servants, those of the world. Again, this contrast is seen. And so here is war. And he is making war against the saints. And how strong is that war in verse 7? Okay, to overcome them. And so some are going to die. You remember back in the sixth chapter in verse 9 about those saints who were at the altar who had been slain for the word of God, for the testimony of Jesus Christ. And they said, how long, O holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood upon those upon the earth? And what were they told? Does anybody remember? Wait a little while. Because you have fellow brethren on the earth that have to yet suffer and yet die. And so God will bring that about. And by the end of the book of Revelation, we see God brings that about. But there's more suffering, more persecution, more loss of life to come as he describes here. And that's an admonition to be faithful. Okay, and we'll talk some more about that as we go through the chapter. And again, how broad is this power that he has in verse 7? Over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. And they worship him in verse 8. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb of God who has been slain. So here's the book of life spoken of. Now, that is spoken of elsewhere in the Bible, and I didn't bring the notes that I scribbled down about that earlier in the week. But as you see, you remember in Exodus chapter 32 when Moses is having to deal with the Israelites, they built the golden calf, and he came down, and he makes an appeal and says, blot my name from your book. And basically God says, those who have sinned, I'll blot out of my book. And he's talking about this concept. I don't understand the book of life is to be some kind of a little notebook that God carries in his pocket. And literally, that's how humans would deal with that. God knows those that are his. That's really what that's about. The book of life is if you would, a record. God's accounting of those who are faithful and walking with him. And who are those people? Okay. In Ephesians chapter 1, there's a description of every spiritual blessing. And God had this plan before the foundation of the world to bless those that are in Christ. And so I think that text is a text that would describe that very thing. Back in Luke chapter 10, in verse 20, after the disciples came back, they had been able to cast out demons, perform these various powers. And Jesus told them, don't rejoice in that, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Yeah, that's impressive stuff, but that's not what this is all about. And so here we find this description of those in the book of life, and at the end of the book of Revelation, we're going to see this term used a number of times. And all those whose names were not written in the book of life were cast into the lake of fire. That's what we're going to see when we get to the 20th chapter. So that makes it a critical question. Is my name in the book of life? We're told back in chapter 3, there those that were faithful to God, their names would not be blotted out of the book of life, which means it could be. And so I want to live faithfully with God in such a way that my name stays in the book of life, if you would. And God's able to take care of that. He's able to make a stand. But here this persecution is going to come against those that are in Christ, basically. Those who are walking with him. And in this statement, if anyone has an ear to hear, let him hear. Remember chapter 2 and 3, the seven churches. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches. There's an admonition, these truths, these warnings. Listen up. If you got to hear an ear to hear God's word, you know, here's the truth. And so we see that expression here. And what do you take from verse 10? I'm just going to stop there since I'm talking way too much. In verse 10, what would you understand that to say?
Something's going to happen. It's going to happen. You're going to be persecuted.
Okay. But you be faithful, then in the end it'll be okay. I think that's the thrust here. There are some, those that kill with the sword, they're going to be destroyed by the sword. They're going to get their come up and God will judge them. But I tend to go with exactly what you said here. That, you know, if you have to die by the sword, die. If you have to suffer, suffer. Okay? This persecution is coming against the saints. And so you hold fast. Here is the perseverance and the faith of the saints at the end of verse 10. Okay, so you hang in there. You persevere. You be steadfast. You be patient. You endure whatever it takes. Okay, and then you will overcome. This is the faith of the saints. Here's the faith. Here's the perseverance and the faith of the saints. You will win. But you will not win without going through the fire. The fires are coming. Okay. Any questions, comments, clarifications, anything down through verse 10 as this beast of Rome is described who would be persecuting the saints. Yeah, we get to chapter 17, it'll be brought back up in some more details. Anything there? So, if not, going once? Going twice?
Just one thing.
Ah, too late.
I've noticed that in the whole book, consistently reminds the saints to have patience and faith because it's all going to be okay, but it's a constant reminder because through all of this suffering, it's very easy to just say, when's God going to fix it? Why is he letting this happen?
Yeah, that's true. We need that constant reminder, don't we? we have to reevaluate and reassure ourselves, no, this is true. This is where it's at. And so I appreciate that, yeah. Here's the patience, the encouragement, exhortation, be faithful. Okay. We need that. I think that's a great point. Okay. Well, the dragon, the devil, is using the political power, using Rome, to persecute the saints, to try to overcome them. That's the sea beast, as described starting in verse 1. In verse 11, then the second beast is introduced. And I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. Now, what kind of a beast do you see described here then?
I think it's a wolf in sheep's clothing kind of thing.
Okay. All right. What's unique about this beast? A lamb. What do you associate a lamb with? You think of these two horns. That would be an association with a lamb. Okay, religion, sacrifice. And I think that's going to be the point that we're going to see in these verses, that this beast coming up out of the earth is going to be the false religion of Rome, which was directly associated with Rome. And again, there were overtones with some of the various Caesars, but definitely Domitian was one who pressed for recognition of the Caesars as being a god. As I understand from the studies that I've been exposed to in history, that the Romans looked at Rome as something more than just a nation. They looked at sort of Rome as a god. They sort of deified Rome. And so they recognized that. And what happened as Rome's history unfolded, some of these leaders, and we talk about a Caesar, that was just a family name, Julius Caesar, and that became known as like the king. Okay, that's where that Caesar comes from. But some of these various Caesars, they would get to thinking pretty high for themselves as they've been maybe victorious in some situations, and there would be this concept of there is a spark of deity in him. He's above men. There's a spark of God in him. And so they had that kind of a concept. And then there became the struggle with the Caesars. You know, is this Caesar raising himself up above Rome? Because Rome, we understand, is God, is a God, and they were worshiping their power. So I've got too philosophical, too historical there, really. But those concepts, I understand, are historically accurate. That's what the writings record and express those things. This beast is one that has two horns like a lamb. And so you think of the religious overtones. Now, if you want to write this down later, when judgment comes upon this particular beast, he's going to be described differently. In the 16th chapter in verse 13, in chapter 19 in verse 20, and in chapter 20 and in verse 10, there's a statement made called the false prophet, which is this beast. It's just another way in the book of Revelation that this particular beast is described. He's described as the false prophet. Again, the religious aspect of the Roman arm that's going to be against Christians. Now, how does he operate in verse 12? It gives us more weight to that thinking, but how does he operate? Verse 12. Okay. So he has the authority of the first beast. He has the Roman Empire behind him. He has that authority and power to enforce, if you would, his religion. And this religion is trying to get them to serve this first beast, the Roman Empire, this religious aspect. Now, as that is described in verse 13 and 14, how does he try to impress people? Of course, remember that one, the wound looked like a fatal wound, and then he revived from that, and people were impressed with that. But how here are they trying to grab people? Okay, by performing great signs. You remember during the 10 plagues, what were the magicians trying to do initially? They were trying to replicate these powers, and finally said, oh, we can't do this. This is the finger of God. You know, this is something more than us. And so you see that kind of thing happening. as you look at the idolatry that took place. I can remember, and I probably mentioned this to you, being at the Oriental Institute many years ago, and there's this big black stone bird. It was this tall, but the base was, you know, about a foot and a half tall. And they had a mirror under there, so you could see in the bottom there was a hole through this stone bird, and the lower jaw on the stone bird was hinged. So they could use ventriloquists to make it appear that their God is speaking. Romans had that same thing. These concilia were magicians. They were ventriloquists. They could perform these things, as I understand history expresses. And so they perform these great signs. And what is their power? Verse 14, Deborah mentioned this earlier. But what is their power? And it is critical to notice this.
Deception.
You remember back in Acts chapter 8? What was Simon the sorcerer doing? He was performing all these tricks to make people think he was some great god, someone great. These priests did these same type of things, and it's throughout human history. And I'll not take time to go back to express more of that, but you see that through the Old Testament. In Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 1 through 5, if one comes along and says that a thing will come to pass, and it comes to pass, and then he says, you come and serve idols, don't follow him. The unique thing about that is one of the tests for a prophet was if he spoke something that came to pass. Deuteronomy 18, then you know he's a prophet of God. But there it says, if he does this, well, he may be using trickery, something of this nature. But even if he's lucky, if he's getting you to try to follow some other god, you don't listen to him. You take him out, he needs to be destroyed. He's a false prophet against God's people. And so you see the Old Testament talking about those kind of challenges. Well, here, the religious arm of the Roman Empire trying to press people to worship the Caesar and give their allegiance to Caesar as a god, that's where their allegiance is. A Christian can't do that. A person of the world can just go on about their business. But push comes to shove. When God says, I am God and here is my will, and when powers like this come and say, you must do this in opposition to the will of God and recognize Rome as God, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him alone shall you worship. From Exodus chapter 20, and at the end of the book of Revelation, when the angel comes to John, that expression is going to be made. And so as he's doing these signs, who is he deceiving in verse 14? The earth dwellers again. Okay. So here we had that back in the first section there. They're impressed with the imperial power. Here these are impressed with these false signs that are taking place. And we find that they are telling people that are on the earth to make an image to the beast who has the wound of the sword and has come to life, which was this political aspect described already earlier in the chapter. The head that was destroyed looked like he died, looked like it's over, and he came back to life. You give credence to them, worship him, make an idol to them. And in verse 15, and there was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast might even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Now there's a different outcome, but in Daniel chapter 3, you remember when Nebuchadnezzar made the great image. Those who don't bow down to this great image, what would happen to them? In that chapter. Yeah, they would die. And in this case, they would be thrown into a furnace back there. Of course, you remember God delivered them. But what we find in this, again, is that Christians may have had to face various persecutions, and we may have to. And he says in verse 16, and he causes all the small and the great and the rich and the poor and the free men and the slaves to be given a mark on their right hand and on their forehead. Now, there has been so much made out of the mark here on their head and their forehead. By the way, it's interesting. Why maybe on their head and some on their forehead? Maybe it has been expressed maybe because some are fully, willingly giving themselves. Others on their hand, under compulsion, are. Whether that's so or not, I'm not sure. That certainly makes a difference, a distinction there. But we find there's somebody else that has a mark on him in this book. Who is that? Back in chapter 7. God's people, heavenly dwellers. And he's not talking about a physical mark, some kind of a tattoo or something. The imagery may come from a slave would be marked as a possession of his master. And so the imagery may come from something like that here. But the bottom line, are you God's or are you this world's? And that's the question we've got to ask ourselves today, certainly. But that's the point that's made here. And here's the mark. This is who I serve. This is who my allegiance is to. This is who I obey, either God or man. And so that contrast is made. And this term mark is used here in chapter 14, and verse 9, verse 11, 16, 2, 19, 20, 20, and verse 4. So we're going to see this mark coming up again throughout the rest of this. But are you God's people or are you not? In 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19, having this seal, God knows those that are his. That's the mark of the seal that's used. And you see that, I think, back in chapter 6, verse 5 and 6, about this discrimination I mentioned earlier that would come against these Christians. Now, in verse 18, since our time is almost gone, in verse 18, here is wisdom, or the ESV renders that also differently, and says, this calls for wisdom. But I really like the idea of here's wisdom. Here's where it's really at. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast. For the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. The number 666 has been used as talking about the mark of the beast, assigned to everything you can imagine. It become almost a publicity stunt, if you would, with many. It is unbelievable what they've done. It is interesting that the number 666 in some manuscripts, it's actually 616. Also, what folks have tried to do is they would take numerical equivalents or values to give to certain letters in their alphabet, and they would come up with a person. And so some have said, well, this is talking about Nero, because you can take the name Nero, take N-E-R-O, and sign certain numerical values. The problem is the languages that are being used, it doesn't even work, because you're talking about Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, and the calculations of these numbers and the names. The name in Latin is spelled different, and that doesn't work. And that's not the point. Here's what I would understand. That six is talking about man. Man, maybe that man was made on the sixth day. It may be that six is short of seven, which is the perfect number and the wholeness of God. But the Greek text here actually says, for the number is that of man. There is no alpha, there's no A in the Greek text. It's the number of man. Just like the earth beast and the sea beast are of this world, here is wisdom. This is earthly. That's what I think. Here's wisdom. Understand this power and all this prestige and all this recognition and all that this beast can offer, or maybe what seems to be delivering you from persecution-wise. This is of man. Listen to God. Here is wisdom. That is of man. And it falls short of God. Now, the next two chapters are going to be, I believe, a couple of chapters of comfort. Because chapter 12, as we said, is, okay, here's this conflict that's going on. The woman is going to be persecuted. Chapter 13, here are two beasts described. The political power and the religious power of Rome. Those arms that are reaching out against the saints. And the saints are going to get hammered. So sort of in a nutshell, the next couple of chapters, I believe, do what he's already done in various places through the book of Revelation, like he did chapter 7. He comes back and gives comfort. Okay, you're going to make it. Here's what's going to happen. You hang in there, brethren. And then he's going to come back and he's going to talk about the wrath that's poured out as this unfolds. So I think this is the logic and the thinking of how these chapters come. They say, okay, here's the battle you're going to have to go through. Here's the fire. But just remember, now here we are. You're going to overcome. You'll win. No, I think that's a good and appropriate observation. The thing is with this, and in chapter 17, is this one that was killed. He did come back, and so he wasn't overcome. And in chapter 17, he uses the number 8, which some observe is the resurrection number, because Jesus resurrected on the eighth day. And so whether that's so or not and all. But yeah, Jesus demonstrated the true power. He's the one that has the keys of death and Hades in chapter 1, verse 18. The devil doesn't have that. Matthew 10:28. They can persecute you. They can kill you. They can take your body. but they run out of steam. We'll need to stop there. We'll pick up here in just a couple minutes for our worship period. Thank you so much. God bless.